Good morning, New Mexico. Welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, streaming on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Santa Fe's Dotfoil Computer Services, and we're at facebook.com/radiocafe. Later in the show, we're going to be speaking to the artist Jerry West, who is showing a wonderful film that includes his work tonight. I'd like now to welcome Neil Franklin. He's a retired Maryland State Police officer for narcotics enforcement. He's a member of Law Enforcement Against Prohibition. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thanks, Mary Charlotte. Glad to be here.
So we are talking today because the U.S. Senate just passed a law that ended a ban on the implementation of a medical marijuana law that the voters of Washington, D.C. passed more than a decade ago. So a decade ago, Washington, D.C. voters said, we want medical marijuana, and the Congress banned it for a decade. Am I understanding that story correctly?
Yes, you are. I believe it was 1998.
And so what happened? Yeah. Tell us the politics of this issue.
Well, anytime you talk about this issue on the potential to legalize any drugs that are currently illegal, marijuana, heroin, and the like, but focusing here on marijuana, politicians, of course, they refer to it as that third rail issue, as you know, as it relates to that issue that the electricity, the rail that the electricity travels through, and nobody wants to touch it. But I think maybe 10 years ago, nationwide, you would find that most of the public, most of the citizens, never even, for the most part, thought about the possibility of legalizing anything that's now legal. So therefore, politicians stayed completely away from it, even though as we moved through this decade, even though when you get behind closed doors with politicians and talk to them about these issues and what prohibition does to us, as we just like it did with alcohol back in the 1920s, most would tend to agree with you, but they knew politically it was suicide. Right just north of Washington, D.C. is Baltimore, and that's where I'm from. Mayor Kurt Schmoke, do you remember him?
Now, who's that?
Mayor Kurt Schmoke was the mayor of Baltimore back in the mid-1990s. He was the one, he was one of the very first politicians, sitting politicians, to come out and say, you know what, this war that we have on drugs, such as marijuana being illegal, you know what, it's not working. We have so much violence, we have so much problems because of it, health issues as well. We need to sit down and have a frank discussion about the direction we're going in. And that was political suicide for him back then in the 1990s. And that's probably, and actually, that was before the voters in Washington, D.C., through this referendum, decided to, you know, where they decided they wanted to make medical marijuana legal in Washington, D.C. So those politicians got a chance to see what happened to Mayor Kurt Schmoke, just 35 miles north of them.
And so what did happen? He wasn't reelected?
Well, you know, he had a bright future, and this is my opinion. As mayor of Baltimore, he did a great job, and he had a bright future. I think he wanted to stay in politics and maybe move into state politics, maybe on a national level as a senator or so, but he was done. And currently he's the dean of the law school at Howard University in Washington, D.C.
Interesting.
So, you know, it's a little bit different today now that groups such as the one I belong to, LEAP, Law Enforcement Against Prohibition, and others have come forward and pretty much said that, you know what, and have not just come forward, but have provided the proof, provided the numbers of incarceration and other things, deaths, the violence. You can just look to Mexico, cartels in over 230 cities here in the United States. And it's now that politicians are beginning to say, you know what, maybe we can come out with this. Maybe we can really voice how we feel about this. And maybe we can, you know, just come out and say, hey, yeah, it's not working. We need to do something else, and we need to move in another direction.
I mean, it's interesting that when the city itself of Washington, D.C. passed a medical marijuana law, and it's not like, you know, they passed a law to legalize you know, methamphetamine or something like that. They passed a medical marijuana law that the Congress felt that it had to get involved in the politics of a city and ban their implementation of their own laws. I mean, that gets into issues of state, local, federal rights and jurisdictions and stuff like that.
Yeah, yeah, it does. And, of course, you know, Washington, D.C. has always had that battle of statehood. You know, that being right there where the nation's capital is, I guess that Congress kind of like felt, well, you know, even though they're not part of the city government per se, it's just their proximity, right smack in the middle, where I guess they felt that they had to kind of like make some sort of statement or what have you. But you said it, the voters a decade ago decided, hey, we want to move forward in this issue, but Congress just stepped right in and blocked it up until now. And
so what happened now? What happened this time?
Well, I think one of the things is what the feds have currently decided to do under the Obama administration as relates to not enforcing those laws that they have over the past, really, close to 40 years. There's been so much of a push. I think it's like 13 states, maybe more now, that are moving forward with medical marijuana and the laws and so forth. And I guess under the Obama administration, they said, you know what? We're not going to change our laws just yet, but you know what? We're no longer going to move forward with prosecuting these people who are seeking the use of marijuana for medical reasons. And I think it was that statement that was made roughly, a month or so, a little over a month ago, close to 2 months ago, that is really spearheading or fostering this change of attitude on a national level.
Who do you think is against medical marijuana and why?
To be honest with you, I think that the only people who are against medical marijuana are those who are misinformed or uninformed. Because I think once you see the facts, once you speak to people who are using it for medical reasons, who may have cerebral palsy, who may be dealing with cancer issues, who may have appetite issues, and you know, from what I understand, the use of marijuana really helps these patients in a number of different areas, not just one. So I think when those folks actually sit down with, or at least listen to what these patients say, when they realize that there are no confirmed deaths, as far as I know, from the use of marijuana, I mean, when you look at other drugs, when you look at things like alcohol and cigarettes, people die from the use of those drugs on a daily basis. I think when people really see the facts and become educated and educate themselves as to the benefits of marijuana, I think that for those medical reasons, I think that then they will change. But I think those who are against it, just either they're not informed at all or they're misinformed. I think the majority are misinformed.
What, if any, role does the pharmaceutical industry have? I mean, I think there is an issue of people being able to grow a plant that then takes the place of a lot of other, perhaps lucrative, drugs that they might be offering.
Yeah, Mary Charlotte, I think you know, as well as most people know, most of your listeners know, when you talk about taking money from big companies, oh, you're in for the fight of your life. I have no doubt that the pharmaceutical companies are going to be completely against this, if not already against it, of this possibility. It will definitely take money from their pockets when someone can, like you said, literally grow this themselves. They don't even have to go to a dispensary.
Are they, I mean, do you know, do they have they had an active lobbying presence against, for example, the law that just passed?
That's possible. Me personally, I haven't really done the research in that area to see if they are actively lobbying in Washington, D.C. and other areas right now to restrict medical marijuana moving forward and you know, with the what the states are doing and what the feds can potentially do to make it even easier for the states to move forward. But I think after our conversation here, I think I'm going to start looking more into that area. I've been spending a lot of my time just focusing on the violence associated with prohibition and the numbers in Mexico and what's going on in Portugal as far as the advances they made and so on. So this is another area I have to dig a little deeper in.
Right, right. Well, let's talk about that. First of all, let's start with your work as a narcotics officer. Tell us about the work you did.
Oh, well, I guess it was around 1981 is when I first started in an undercover role with the Maryland State Police. I'd been on a couple of years, but then I moved into an undercover role in Southern Maryland, which actually the counties in Southern Maryland border Washington, D.C. And I spent a lot of time locking people up, many of which were for nonviolent drug offenses, quite a few for marijuana possession. And, of course, even if someone was growing one single plant on their balcony, which I had written search warrants for someone's apartment, they're not just charged with possession, but they're also charged with manufacturing, which is a felony. So, you know, when I look at it now, back then I didn't see what I see now as it relates to what that arrest can do to someone's life. Now, I know it's the law, it's against the law, and I've taken an oath to uphold the laws. But I've taken a position now to do whatever I can to change those laws because I've learned a lot more. I've learned just how violent prohibition has made our country. Just looking back at the examples of Al Capone back in the 1920s with alcohol, it was a very violent time in this country because of that. And, you know, it's not the drug use that brings the violence to our doorsteps. It is the prohibition of those drugs that brings the violence. When I started back in the early 1980s, I would even go out by myself making cases associating with people in the drug world, illegal drug world. I would not even be armed. I would not have a partner. I would do it all by myself. As we moved into the latter part of the 80s and early 90s, we would not even permit our narcotics agents to go out by themselves or unarmed because it had become more violent. The culture had become more violent, and the violence is steadily increasing as I speak to you today. I commanded in the late 80s and the 1990s, I commanded a number of narcotics task forces here in the state of Maryland, which is multi-jurisdictional task forces in the effort against the war on drugs. I even commanded the Maryland State Police Training Division for a couple of years before retiring and moving on to Baltimore Police Department. I commanded their Training and Education Division for a while. So I've seen it from many different perspectives, and also growing up in Baltimore, I got to see it from the perspective of living in a community and some of the issues that are related to drug prohibition, which is more of a problem than drug use.
What happened between the time that you could go out unarmed as a single officer and make a drug arrest to the time where you had to be armed and had to have a whole team of people? What happened? What was the nature of that transition?
Well, speaking specifically for Baltimore, this is what happened. In the late 60s and in the 70s and even into the early 80s, Baltimore was pretty much controlled on the illegal drug scene by maybe three or four major organizations. And these organizations pretty much had agreements, you know, like unwritten contracts as to how they would go about doing their business, who had what territory, and what they could do and what they couldn't do. Back then, when the homicides would occur related to this business, they were pretty much confined to those folks who decided to partake in that business. And if they didn't go along with the rules that they owed someone money or whatever, then they would turn up dead somewhere. What happened is when we in law enforcement came along and decided to take down these organizations, we were going to be hard on, you know, tough on drugs, I believe how they put it. And so we started taking down these organizations, and I remember working on a couple of those task forces that did so here in Baltimore. When we did that, it paved the way. It just opened the floodgates for many entrepreneurs to come onto the scene. And literally hundreds of small drug organizations took over the streets. Now, they had no unwritten contracts. They had no verbal agreements. It was all about how can I control my market share, maintain my market share, and it came about, hey, violence, okay? Whoever had the most violent members in the organization usually won, and the dealing went out into the streets, open-air drug markets. You now had drive-by shootings because that's where the bad guys were, standing on the corner selling the drugs so the neighboring gangs, organizations could now just drive by and eliminate them by shooting them. Innocent people getting caught in the crossfire made it extremely dangerous for cops. In October of 2000, a very close friend of mine, Trooper Edward Totley, was assassinated in Washington, D.C., working with a federal task force making a drug buy. That was really the turning point for me, and that's when I started publicly speaking out regarding this issue.
We're talking to Neil Franklin, retired Maryland State Police Officer for Narcotics Enforcement, and he's a member of Law Enforcement Against Prohibition. I think it's important to talk about, first of all, what the drugs were that you most often busted people for and how those drugs differed from one another, both in the effects of in the people who took them, but also in the way that they did or didn't spawn the kind of violence that you're talking about.
Most of the arrests were made and continue to be made this day are for marijuana and marijuana possession. More people use marijuana in this country than any other drug, and it's easy to make those arrests. And we in law enforcement would make those arrests, the easy arrests, so that we could, you know, try to what we would call spin that person, get them to tell us who their dealers and suppliers are or lead us in a direction for someone selling a harder drug such as heroin or cocaine, what we consider called as harder drugs. One thing that this is very interesting, and I'll start with marijuana use real quick. If the only drug being used was marijuana, I'd never experience a violent marijuana user. Now, if they were using alcohol in conjunction with it, if it was laced with PCP, maybe it's a different story. However, if it was just marijuana, never violent. And as a matter of fact, any police officer will tell you, when they go on calls for domestic violence or disorderly conduct, the drug of choice is usually alcohol. It's never just marijuana.
Right.
Marijuana users are typically very passive. The other drugs, heroin, very seldom is a heroin user aggressive. Also, it's a depressant. And it actually has a calming effect on people. It's just like morphine. It's basically morphine. And so that use is in and of itself is typically never a problem as it relates to someone's behavior, you know, being aggressive and being dangerous to those interacting with that person. Cocaine being a stimulant could be a little different. But usually you'll find that people have violent tendencies or issues when they maybe combine some drugs, and they may have an adverse reaction to those drugs. But, you know, like I said, far beyond the use as it relates to violence, it's the issue where the violence comes in is the prohibition piece, where people are protecting their money source, their market share. And it doesn't matter what country you're in, that's what you're going to have. So it's not really the drug use, it's the prohibition.
So you were arresting people who were mostly kind of at the bottom of the corporate structure, so to speak? In other words, so the people who were the president or the kingpin or whatever you want to call it of the drug corporation or cartel, you weren't arresting those people.
Yeah, it's very difficult to get to them. There's so many layers in between those at the bottom and the person at the top orchestrating the whole network. It's very difficult to get. You're, for instance, unfortunately, when a jurisdiction, when a city or a state looks at the numbers of arrests and what the arrests are for, felonies versus misdemeanors related to drugs and drug possession and distribution, they don't really see the level of within the organization that this arrest is attached to. For instance, if you lock someone up for distribution, which is a felony, and they're street level, and you look at that number on a spreadsheet for someone who has been arrested as a at a higher level, a kingpin level, that number's relatively the same. You know, it's a felony arrest for distribution. And when you've got federal grants such as the Byrn Grant, which distributes money, federal money, to these local police departments and jurisdictions, all they're looking at are the numbers on a spreadsheet. So I can make more distribution arrests and possession arrests at the street level than spending 6 months to a year or 18 months on a high-level investigation going after a kingpin. We have those organizations, we have those departments and units within any law enforcement agency, any major law enforcement agency, which focus on the organized crime piece, to hire the kingpins and those higher up in the organizations. We have them, but they spend 6 months, a year, year and a half on an investigation and end up making maybe 20, 30 arrests out of, you know, when that thing is culminated. But I could put a squad out on a street and lock that many people up in one night.
Right.
And so, unfortunately, those folks at the lower level are scooped up by the tens every day in a city like Baltimore. And, you know, they paid a price for it. And also, unfortunately, they can be replaced just as quick.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it seems like there's either willful or ignorant non-understanding on the part of the people who distribute the law enforcement dollars and make those laws.
And here's the other thing, Mary Charlotte. As the chief of police in a community, the citizens call in daily, I mean, multiple times during the day, saying, hey, you got to get these drug dealers off my corner. And, you know, these law enforcement agencies only have so many people to send out. The resources are limited. So they have to provide that service for their constituents, for their citizens, and they're going to send the squads out to clear the corners. And how do you do that? You lock them up.
Yeah. Tell us about the work that you've been doing regarding the whole scene in Mexico.
Well, I personally don't go out of Mexico, but the research that I do, I try to keep track of the numbers. I try to keep track of the different cartels and what area they're working in. For instance, I was out in Phoenix just last week, and I was out there for one reason, but I knew that Phoenix was the number two city in the world, not the country, in the world, for drug-related kidnappings. They average about one kidnapping a day in Phoenix, Arizona. And I got a chance to talk to and do a little research while I was out there. And they have a squad called the Hike Squad, which is the Home Invasion Kidnapping Enforcement. And they focus on this. This is all they do, is go and try to get these people who are kidnapped back and make the arrest of those kidnappings. The reason being that they have these kidnappings is because of their proximity to Mexico. Those cities along the U.S. border, El Paso, Phoenix, Las Cruces, San Diego, and California, and so on, are dealing with these types of issues and have a lot of violence that they're trying to keep a lid on. Mexico, many people know that in 2008 in Mexico, they had well over 6,000 homicides, drug-related homicides. And one of the things that people don't understand is that the United States law enforcement, the FBI, has established a crime tracking system that all law enforcement agencies have to, where they have to submit their data as it relates to crime. And we are not as good, for whatever reason, at keeping specific numbers on drug-related homicides here in the United States. For it to be classified as a drug-related homicide, the criteria is very high. And if you really well, an example in Baltimore, we have about 250 murders a year. Any cop will tell you that probably 75% to 80% of those homicides are drug related. If it weren't for drug prohibition, they wouldn't have occurred. That's how I'm putting it. And when you start going across the country, looking at those numbers, city by city, we have well surpassed the Mexico homicide numbers as relates to drug-related murders in this country. I think I feel very safe at saying that those numbers here in the United States are anywhere from 8,000 to 12,000 homicides annually.
Wow.
As it relates to drug-related murders in the United States. But we hear about Mexico, but we don't hear about those numbers here in the United States. They're extremely high.
Very interesting.
Because of prohibition. And that's why I keep looking at Mexico. The drug cartel, they're in well over 230 cities here in the United States, and it's going to get worse. This violence from Mexico and from the cartel is going to get worse, and that's why I'm trying to keep an eye on what's happening in Mexico.
You mentioned also a moment ago Portugal and what's happening there.
Well, Portugal had decided to decriminalize not just marijuana, but all their drugs. So even though it may still be illegal, they're not prosecuting people for possessing marijuana, heroin, cocaine, and the likes. And they're actually closing prisons for one thing. And here's just a couple of numbers from what's going on in Portugal since they've done this. They started this back in the early 2000s. I believe it was around 2001. And since then, Portugal has the lowest rate of lifetime marijuana use in people over 15. For instance, I think that's at 10%. If you look at the United States, it's around 39%. Between 2001 and 2006 in Portugal, lifetime use of any illegal drug among 7th through 9th graders fell from 14% to 10.6%. HIV infections has dropped for new cases between 99 and 2003. HIV cases has fallen by 17%.
So it's interesting to me. I mean, I would think, you know, I'm sitting here in the Santa Fe Baking Company talking to you, a law-abiding citizen, and I would think that when, for example, if marijuana or some other drugs were to be decriminalized or to be legalized, I might be more likely to use them because what's keeping me now from doing it is I don't want to break the law.
But you're one of the few who feel like, okay, I'm not going to do it because I don't want to break the law. I find that most kids who don't use drugs don't use because they've been educated regarding the dangers, not that it's illegal. See, the penalties for someone who is below the age of 18 in this country are a lot different than someone who is 18 or older. And most kids are pretty smart. They know if they got caught using marijuana that pretty much nothing would happen to them,
right,
as it relates to the law. Kids would also tell you that, hey, it's a lot easier for me to go get illegal drugs than to go try to buy a beer or cigarettes, because they need a third party for that. As relates to illegal drugs, all they need is money. But, yeah, that's always been what you said. It's always been the thought, we make this stuff legal, the more people are going to use it. But when you look at whether it's in the Netherlands or whether what I'm talking about here with Portugal, when you look at their numbers, and this report that I'm referring to, these numbers are coming from the Cato Institute, who did the research as it relates to Portugal. They found the opposite. And I for one, know, I mean, I used to be a kid, believe it or not. I for one, know a lot of the stuff that kids do, and I did back then, we did strictly because, hey, it went against the grain.
Right.
I mean, really, you know, being rebellious, you know, I'm going to, hey, it's against the law, it's right, I'm going to do it.
Right.
And many of the kids, for instance, in the Netherlands they think marijuana use is boring.
Yeah, that's true. I've met people from Holland.
Old people do it.
Yeah,
they don't
want
to do what old people do.
And, you know, that's, back, a lot of these guys, the baby boomers, you know, they were the big marijuana users back in the 60s and so on. And who wants to be like them? What kid wants to be like them? No kid wants to be like their parents as it relates to this stuff.
So you are making a good case for the legalization or decriminalization of drugs based on the tremendous violence and basically huge illegal cartels and completely uncontrolled and uncontrollable cartels that arise from the prohibition of drugs. Do you feel that all drugs should be legalized or decriminalized, or some of them?
I believe that all drugs should be legalized. Prohibition should end for all drugs, because as long as you prohibit a drug, you have set the stage for the criminal enterprise to come along and make money from it. It's not just the cartel in Mexico. It's not just the gangs here in the United States. It's also terrorists who benefit from the prohibition of drugs. The Taliban makes its money, not all of it, but a large portion of it, from the sale of opium. And it's because it's illegal. So until we end prohibition for every drug, we're going to have these issues. We're going to continue. And here's a good example. You familiar with football?
Only marginally, but yeah.
Okay. Well, like many team sports such as football or soccer or lacrosse, you have a huge field and you have one team trying to move an object in a particular direction. The opposing team is trying to prevent that movement of that object in that direction to score a goal, correct? This is the only game that we're talking about right here, Mary Charlotte, on your show, where you have both teams on the same side of the field moving in the same direction. You see, because our federal government wants this stuff to remain illegal, to keep prohibition in effect. So does the cartel. So does the terrorists. So do our criminal gangs here in the United States. They don't want to see this stuff legal because it takes the money out of their pockets.
Yeah, I mean, I was listening to an interesting debate on the BBC the other night, and there was one guy in favor of drug legalization and another guy against it, and the guy against it was making the point that when you legalize gambling, that doesn't decrease illegal gambling, and whether that is a salient point or not, maybe you can address or not, but what he was...
There's one big difference when you talk about legal gambling versus illegal gambling. And that is the violence. See, I'm about, and we at LEAP are about saving lives. We're about saving lives. Addiction rates, we don't know for sure if they'll go up. It's possible they might. You know what? But someone who is addicted can be cured. Someone who is addicted can get help. When people die, that's the end of the story. There's no coming back from that. And we have people dying by the thousands, literally by the hundreds, as we speak right now across this world, not just here in the United States, but across the world because of prohibition of drugs. So, and also as it relates to gambling, and I beg to differ, yeah, there might be a little bit of illegal gambling still going. You might find a dice game on a corner or so on, or an illegal poker game above some restaurant or what have you. But I tell you one thing, the illegal numbers game that used to exist here in Baltimore City, which I know about because my father was a part of it, it doesn't exist anymore. It doesn't exist on a syndicate level, let me put it that way.
Right. Now, do you see the public consciousness changing? I mean, the example, going back to the beginning of the show, the example of the Congress finally lifting the ban on Washington, D.C., having its medical marijuana law finally upheld. That's one example, but on a more nationwide level, what are you seeing?
Definitely the numbers indicate that there is a shift, that there is a change, and not just as it relates to our politicians. When I was out in New Mexico last month, I actually took a trip up to your town. Nice town, by the way.
Oh, we should have stopped by, but anyway, go ahead.
Yeah. But even as it relates to our citizens across the country, there have been, I think one of the most recent polls is the Angus Reid public opinion poll. And I think they surveyed just a little over 1,000 people nationally. And 70%, for instance, believe that we have a drug abuse problem and that it needs to, the way we're going about it, it needs to change. And I think also in that poll, I think it was, I'll make sure I'm remembering these numbers right. I think it was about two-thirds, somewhere around 68%, believe the war on drugs, of course, has been a failure. These are citizens. There's also a large number of people, I think it was 53%, believe that they should go ahead and legalize marijuana. And these numbers continue to rise in favor, for instance, of legalizing marijuana on, you know, as it relates to the citizens in this country. And I think as the politicians, like I said, they already know. Politicians, have all, most of them, have already done the research in this area, and they know what the facts are, unlike many of our citizens. But as our citizens begin to hear more and more and more of the facts related to these, to this subject, then they're these polls will continue to post those numbers, and politicians then will begin to act, will begin to put forth legislation and support legislation.
Yeah, one hopes so. One hopes so, Neil. But you know what? Looking at the health care reform debate and how the large majority of people are in favor of the public option and they've been overshadowed by the pharmaceutical companies, it'll be very interesting to see how the pharmaceutical companies and the private prison industry responds to any attempt to legalize drugs.
Well, we know what their response is going to be. They're going to be against it because it's all about money. And it's not just about money for those folks. It's about money for the average citizen, too. And when the average citizen realizes that this country is spending or losing $76.8 billion annually supporting this war on drugs effort, then you know what? They'll also see it from a different perspective, too, from the pocketbook perspective. And that's a low-end figure that Jeffrey Myron from Harvard came up with about a year ago. The number is much higher. We're wasting so much money. One of the big issues with the health care program that they're trying to enact now is that most people see it as being very costly. This move, what we're talking about here, ending prohibition, puts money back into our coffers as citizens and as governments and as cities and towns. Considerable money that we can use towards health, that we could use towards education, that we could use towards treatment. It's unbelievable. And you know, if you don't get the saving of life, harm reduction, if you don't get that, then maybe you'll get the money into this. We're spending a lot of money as a nation, an awful lot.
Neil Franklin is a retired Maryland State Police Major for Narcotics Enforcement. He's a member of Law Enforcement Against Prohibition. Thanks so much for being with us.
Mary Charlotte, I thank you very much for having me. And the next time I get out to Santa Fe, I'm going to find you.
Okay, great. Look forward to it. I'm very, very happy now to welcome Jerry West. He is a painter, and he will be speaking tonight at Tipton Hall, sponsored by the Santa Fe Art Institute, and showing a film that he made, or that he helped to make, called A Prairie Night. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Well, Mary Charlotte, it's a pleasure to be here. It really is.
Now, you were born in the 1930s in this area, in northern New Mexico.
No, that's another long story, but I will bring that up when I talk tonight. I was born in Ohio.
Ah.
My parents had been here in Santa Fe for a number of years. My older brother and my sister were born here. My sister was born in a little homestead south of Santa Fe, way out on the prairie, what we call now the prairie country. She was born on a homestead in the middle of a snowstorm, so to speak, you know, and the doctor came all the way out across those roads that were unpaved and birthed my little sister. Then they went back to Ohio during the real height of the Depression, and I was born back there in that one year, and Hal went on got a job, and Hal, my father, went on to Cincinnati, got a job, and the next year he got a job back in Santa Fe. So that we came back on the train, I and my older brother and sister and my mama, and we went back to Canyon Road and lived there. So I'm almost a native in that respect.
And I think, what's so interesting about this short film is that it shows a northern New Mexico, Santa Fe, and in this environment, the way it was in your memory, in your dreams, in the early part of the 20th century. Mm-hmm. And it's a very unromanticized look at this part of the country in some ways.
Yeah, it has that sense of romance also, but it is, and it was, I think, purposefully, I was having a lot of dreams in that period. It was a very tumultuous time in my own life, and some travel, getting away from Santa Fe. I mean, to get to New York, as I say, a country boy, I'd been to big cities, but I'd never been in New York City. And I got there, met a woman who we traveled together, went to Greece, places like that, went to Mexico. Subsequently met Maridel and came back here, and we started a whole other period of our life. And Maridel was incredibly important in my work. She was the one who sort of really supported that kind of digging into your own psyche and your own work.
Now, so when did you make the paintings that are shown in the film?
I made them in 1980s from a little studio. Maridel had gone to Colorado, University of Colorado, as a guest artist, and I took a little studio down Larimer Street in Denver. And it was kind of isolated in a sense, and it was a little upstairs space, narrow and beautiful in a way, and I fixed it up, and I was doing smaller paintings. I started doing very intense kind of drawings and paintings of the dreams that I had kept records of for the last, 5 or 6 years of my life in that period. And they all seem to be about growing up in a time, in a place, in the war years, the post-war years, and some very troubled times, kind of emotionally, and yet some very wonderful times, So war in New Mexico, we were pretty isolated, but it was still pretty amazing times. And then to watch and to be around and watch the development of Los Alamos from a distance. We didn't know much about it in 1943. We just knew this mysterious thing was happening. And that was country where I had been as a kid. And my older brother and I had walked that country and explored it intensely, as young men. And to see this whole country now being changed and blasts, the road blasted and all the explosions that went on for a number of years, it was kind of, we knew something grave and serious was happening there.
The film A Prairie Night was shot by Stena and Woody Vaselka, and there's all sorts of recordings in it, sound recordings, not only of your voice kind of narrating, but also recordings that you made in the 1950s?
Well, probably more. I started teaching in Santa Fe High School in 1959, and I was in and out of teaching. I finally went, my last 3 years of teaching were at Santa Fe Prep, in the early, early days of Prep when we were up on Canyon Road. And it was during that period that I was messing around a lot with reel-to-reel, and in my classes, I would bring people into the classroom, and we would I would either interview with them or whatever, and record them and that sort of thing. So you'll hear an old Tewa Indian talking, and that was one of the guys. But there were other old characters that came in and out of our family, and from that, I would record and a family gathering, and my kids as little kids, around a Christmas party, or people coming and talking about Hal. So many of these dreams happened way after Hal died. He died in 1968.
And so your father died in 68, and there's a lot of memories of your father in your work.
Yeah, and families in general. My brother Arch, who I, for some reason, kind of is my alter ego or something, he was the one who never left the prairie, who knew what he wanted to do from the very early on in his life, and he continued to be a rancher, I was always troubled by being in one spot or whatever, and but it was always pulled back. You know, it's kind of like wherever I was in the world, you know, it could be in Mitla, Mexico, and I had these intense dreams of the prairie. And so way, in some ways, and I guess dealing with a Jungian psychologist, an analyst, it was pretty interesting because I sat with John Talley for a while, and a man who at least gave me courage to go ahead and use the dream possibly as a launching point for more interesting work. And before that, I was certainly encouraged back in the graduate years when I was at Highland University studying little art. Elmer Schooley was a great teacher, but he certainly did everything in his power to get me away from this kind of storytelling.
Why?
Because the mantra of the day, you know, in abstract expressionism, you didn't bring emotional images into a painting. Emotion for Schooley and that whole great movement of art was to keep personal images out of it, and the emotion came from the way in which you handle paint and the passages of paint and color and design and kind of intense things that happen within the paint itself.
Right. Yeah, and classic modernism.
Yeah, exactly. And it took me a lot of years, and it was probably wandering around New York and being in touch with black artists and the women artists and eventually getting in touch with somebody like Maribel.
Your partner, Maribel Rubinson.
Yeah. And she was certainly, you know, a classic kind of a woman who had fought that and was a real feminist artist in a sense.
And so basically you had to fight against the dominant art establishment in order to have personal and emotional imagery in your work.
I think so.
That's crazy.
I think, well, it was. But, and, you know, it took me a while, and then I got to the point where I was just going to do it, and I wasn't any longer concerned with what other people thought about it, which everybody has to get past that particular.
Right, right.
You know, the people who kind of guided you, it takes a long time to kind of get past that.
So this film that people are going to see tonight if they go at 6 o'clock to Tipton Hall is one of the things that's interesting about it is you've got some paintings that are apparently quite large and have a lot of imagery in them, but we see them in the film in their many
right.
details, sort of traveling around from one place to the other, more than you see the big
picture.
Yeah,
I have to give credit to Steno Vasolka for that, you know, because she was the one who basically did the filming. And they actually are not large paintings. I mean, I painted a lot larger than that. They're probably about a 36 by 48, you know, format. But and they're all done with acrylics, which was something I hadn't been working with. I work most often in oil, but they were done in the small studio in Denver, Colorado. And at the time when I finally got a show on Garcia Street in a little gallery we called Height Bear, they gave me the freedom to actually put together the gallery in a sense. And I painted the walls blue. I did animal tracks. I did three-dimensional little shrines and things hanging like a Zuni Shalako house or something like that with the old butte. And particular things that were really intense in my growing up, like the old butte, which was a focal point for so many things. And so I did that, and the sound piece, as I said earlier, was made from these early recordings of my family. And then I recorded animal sounds and windmill sounds and water dripping or whatever, just to give it this kind of... And when I wanted it to be kind of a dreamscape in a sense that to walk in there and be a little more like a dream. And I really wanted to depict kind of the underbelly of that world that I'd grown up in, which was not all dark. I mean, there was a lot of darkness which I felt should be brought out and at least mentioned. And it was not favorably accepted by everybody. Many of my old relatives, I had an uncle who walked out of the show. He was so disturbed by the imagery.
Jerry West is a painter, and he will be showing the film tonight, A Prairie Night. It's at 6 o'clock at Tipton Hall, sponsored by the Santa Fe Art Institute. For more information, you can call the Art Institute at 505-424-5050. And you can also find them at sfai.org. And the film A Prairie Night was shot by Stena and Woody Veselka. And we look forward to seeing you there and seeing this film.
Mary Charles, it's been a pleasure to be with you. Okay,
thank you. You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming live on the web at ksfr.org. My email address is radiocafe@ksfr.org. We're podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Santa Fe's Dotfoil Computer Services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes, and you can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team, and after that, the Colors of Jazz.